Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Edward Schmieder. The Russian-born violinist and conductor has just joined the faculty at Temple's Boyer School of Music and Dance. The group he founded and directs, E. Palpity, performs in Philadelphia and at Carnegie Hall in New York next week. Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of sound designers in theatre programs. We'll hear from local designers James Sugg and Jorg Kosinu about their behind-the-scenes work. Neither arms nor diplomacy has achieved peace in the Middle East, but a group of musicians is not giving up on the prospect of living in harmony. Susan Lewis reports on Intercultural Journeys, a Philadelphia-based group that this month brings together Arab and Jewish musicians playing the music of both traditions in special concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
In January, Edward Schmieder became the Laura H. Carnell Professor of Violin at Temple's Boyer School of Music and Dance. The Ukrainian-born violinist and conductor was a child prodigy. In 1953, his family moved to Tajikistan to avoid the last of Stalin's purges, after which Edward Schmieder crossed a continent alone at age 13 to study at the famous St. Petersburg State Conservatory. He spent 4 years there, seeing his family just once or twice a year, before moving to Moscow, where he met his wife Laura, started a family, and began to receive acclaim as one of the nation's finest young solo performers and instructors. In 1979, Edward Schmieder moved his family from the Soviet Union to the United States. He first settled in Chicago, where he took freelance work before eventually landing an academic position in Texas. Before coming to Temple, Edward Schmieder held a prestigious post as Yasha Heifetz's successor at the University of Southern California. He also held a named professorship at Southern Methodist University. Since 1997, Edward Schmieder has conducted and directed E. Palpity, an orchestral ensemble made up of prize-winning young professional musicians. When he came to our studios earlier this week, I first asked him about why he had founded the group.
Being grateful to God that I can work in the field I was trained, I felt it's my responsibility to help young musicians. I was fortunate to work with many, many, many gifted young musicians. To do it immediately by myself, I couldn't. I needed support of very big name, very big personality. I spoke with Isaac Stern, who was very good to me, but he said that, look, great talent will find a way. I did not agree with him. I spoke with many other people. Finally, Yehudi Menuhin, late Lord Yehudi Menuhin, immediately reacted to my request, and we founded with him an organization called Young Artists International, which is promoting, helping young musicians, and sometimes helping in a very simple way, to buy concert clothes, to rent a hall, to hire an accompanist, and so forth. And E. Palpity is actually a branch, a child of this organization, where young musicians, approximately 25, between 25 and 30 members who come from all over the world, who are proteges in their own countries, are getting together to play in orchestral ensemble, to play chamber music, and to play solo. We are fortunate we had an opportunity to play in many important halls, in many important festivals. We opened season in Salzburg a couple of years ago. And now we are looking forward very much to play for the audience in Philadelphia and Carnegie Hall. So hopefully we will do okay.
Is E. Palpity then composed only of musicians who are trying to become established?
Well, we have not only young musicians who are seeking career playing, but many of them already are concertmeisters, leaders of important orchestras. They are coming back, and they are coming back, as they say, for spiritual experience. And if I may, I will tell you what it means exactly. I am a great believer that music manifests itself not only in sounds, not only in rhythm, but in emotional energy. I know that some people may argue with me, and they may say, and how do you measure scientifically this emotional energy? My answer is that relatively, in historic terms, relatively in a short time, people who spoke about radio waves were confined to mental institutions because radio waves could not be measured. I do believe that great artists do send emotional signals to the audience. Otherwise, how does it happen that you may hear not perfect virtuoso and leave the concert absolutely unmoved, and we may hear the person who may be not perfect, but moves us to the depth of our heart. This is something what I believe very much. This is what I try to communicate to people with whom I work. This is what I teach them in a way. And this is why they come back already from very important positions. Recently, one of my former students who plays in Berlin Philharmonic said, may I come to play in the pulpit? And I say, why? She said, we play with great conductors, but we do not have the spiritual energy. And this happens. My concertmaster now in the pulpit is concertmaster of Berlin Chamber Orchestra. He comes back already for many years. They say they come back to recharge themselves. And maybe this is the factor which is, in a way, different from many other ensembles. When we are playing, for us, of course, the ensemble is extremely important. The technique is extremely important. The text is extremely important. The epoch in which composer lived is extremely important. But the most important for us is to move the audience. Because if the audience will not be moved emotionally, they will go to football game. Or they will go to the popular concerts. And we will lose them. You know that today classical music experiences problems because not necessarily young people are exposed to great music. In many ways, it is fault of musicians because we become very academic. Sometimes musicians are performing for musicians and they are coming to hear how one can handle well the instrument and how one can follow certain idea that Baroque music has to be performed in certain style or in another style. But this is temporary. The tastes are changing in music. The ideas how certain styles have to be performed is changing historically. What is not changing, is it emotionally moving or not? And this is the most important thing. I believe in that. It's my belief. And I think that reaction of the audience proves that something what we are doing is right.
Final question. You've now dedicated yourself to educating students. Do you have any ambitions for your own musical career, or is all of that ambition related to how well your students progress in their careers?
Mostly with my students, for simple reason. As a violinist, as a solo violinist, my career is over. I was severely injured, and this is what made me a teacher. If I would not be severely injured, I would not know how to teach because I was child protege. For me, everything was easy. At very early age, I played Paganini and Mendelssohn concerto as a soloist with orchestra in my early teens. If I would not be injured, I would not know how to teach. As a conductor, I started very late. And I doubt that I will be able to conduct major orchestra because if even such thing will happen, I am not sure that I will agree to present a concert with three or four rehearsals.
You'll be lucky to get four rehearsals.
Yeah, and I don't think. So I live in my students and young people performing under my direction. Only audience can judge, but I know that after most of the concerts, I heard comments, dozens if not hundreds, that they enjoy this much more sometimes than very famous group performing because of sincerity of that, because of point of view of that, and because of the level of that. Musicians who are playing under my direction are doing that not because they are connected with the union or because they make certain amount of money or because they have to do living. They do that because they burn and because they love.
Thank you. An excerpt from the finale of Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings, recorded live at Disney Hall in LA in 2004. Edward Schmieder conducting E Palpiti. Schmieder leads E Palpiti in Jewels of Russia, a program featuring works by Shostakovich and Tchaikovsky at Congregation Rodef Shalom's historic synagogue at 615 North Broad Street in Philadelphia at 8 on Monday. The concert is free and open to the public. On Wednesday, Schmieder and E Palpiti perform the same program at Carnegie Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
One element in theatre that tends not to get a lot of attention is sound design. The Tony Awards, for example, annually honour the best in costume, set and lighting design, but they don't acknowledge sound designers with an award. Yet the work of those who make a production sing or talk has not historically received a lot of recognition. Thanks to advances in technology, the field has grown tremendously in recent decades, increasingly regarded as an important component of theatre productions. Now, as part of a continuing series about what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer provides a behind-the-scenes look at sound design.
Next time you go to a theatre production, particularly a straight play, think about what you're hearing during the show, other than actors talking or an audience member opening candy. Maybe it's a helicopter. Or scratchy music meant to feel as if it's drifting from a record player. Or maybe it's sound that has no logical connection to what's happening on stage, but it helps create a certain mood. Pay attention to where it's coming from. Behind you? From the stage? Off stage? From wherever, and whatever it might be that you're hearing, chances are it was put there by a sound designer. Which begs the basic question, what exactly does a sound designer do?
A sound designer is essentially a composer in sound.
David Badriz is the chair of the sound design program at the Yale School of Drama.
So anything that you can imagine in the realm of real sound, abstract sound, imagined sound, synthesized sounds, the entire world of audible sound becomes part of the palette for a sound designer.
Badriz says that there are a lot of common misconceptions surrounding the work of a sound designer, in part because so many facets of a theater production can fall within the purview of this role. On the one hand, there's the technical side. This might involve analyzing the acoustics of a theater, miking the actors, overseeing placement of speakers, and running a soundboard. Here, a sound designer uses technology to support or reinforce the performance and story of a play. The role also involves what's often called conceptual sound design. This entails molding, shaping, and layering sound that might be composed or recorded from an everyday environment. In short, conceptual sound design is part of a show's creative expression. David Badriz, who's been a sound designer and educator for over 25 years, says the frequent confusion about this design element has to do with many people thinking of sound design primarily as a technical field.
At one point, it might have been leaning much, much more in that direction, if not fully in that direction at times, where, you know, the development of the early Broadway shows was primarily dealing with issues of reinforcement, getting the voices up, and it was pioneering some of the new technologies and radio microphones and loudspeaker systems and controlling patterns of loudspeakers or whatnot. So there was a huge necessary development of the technology in order to support the artist. I think what's happened now is that the reality is the sound designers are turning in much, much more into artists.
Although the sound designer role in theater isn't brand new, it at least dates back to the 1960s, and sound editors and composers in film have been doing similar work for years. But Rees estimates that it probably wasn't until the early 80s that the term started to become more widely recognized and used in theater. Since then, the field has grown a great deal. Sound design programs have popped up in universities across the country. Increasingly, Bud Rees says, the profession is especially drawing designers with a strong creative bent, not just a technical background. James Sugg is a Philadelphia-based actor, composer, and sound designer who's garnered multiple awards for his work in the region. He's done sound design for about 8 years, including the electric guitar sound design sample you heard earlier, and this piece from Pig Iron Theater Company's production Hell Meets Henry Halfway. Sugg says although a lot of his work relates to simple sound effects or transition music between scenes, He gets most excited about using audio as a driving and defining element of the play, in some ways, enabling the sound to be a character in the piece.
On rare occasions, sound gets to do what the actors can't do, or take the action or the emotion to a higher level. You know, there's something about the heightened emotions of great symphonies, or even sometimes of a single violin, you know, or that can express an emotion or a quality that an actor can't. So sometimes I see it as like the grand geste, the great gesture.
That James Hugg compares sound design in a play to a symphonic work isn't surprising. He comes from a musical background. But Jorg Cousino, who's been designing sound for theater and dance in Philadelphia for about 7 years, likens the work to visual art.
My background is actually in painting. So I started out as a painter. But as far back as I can think, it's always been equally interesting, the sound and the image. There's something about the combination of sound and image. How do they go together? Is there something universal about the scheme of color and the scheme or the range or the spectrum of sound that actually have a similar logic to them? And ever since I was studying in school, I've always tried to apply the same theoretical rules or criteria that apply to painting and color to sound as well.
Cousino explains that like visual composition, there's a balancing act involved with sound production. Although a designer might love freedom to be creative, the work needs to complement the narrative and fit into the scheme of a director's overall vision for a show.
Sound is not always as helpful in the whole mix because it can actually divert attention from what's most important about a story. So often it comes down to the few moments where sound really has to indicate a certain scene change or a different place or a jump in time, or, you know, sometimes it's very direct things like the phone is ringing.
Striking a balance with the right sound at the right moment is tricky, according to James Hugg. Using a well-known song, for instance, carries connotations that can extend far beyond the world of a play. Hugg says because sound can have a subtle, even psychological power to shift a perception of a scene, sometimes instantly, it can become overly manipulative.
You have to be very careful with it. You don't want to force anything. At least I don't. I want to be very careful about not telling an audience how to feel, unless that's what we're going for.
And different sound designers indeed are going for different things in their work. The field is growing more and more diverse and innovative. Yale professor David Badri says in many ways, sound design is only at the beginning of its development.
There's an incredible trajectory ahead of us, I think, a path that is very difficult to fully define, but it's certainly, at the moment, I would not consider it be a diminishing field. I think it's still finding its voice.
As sound design continues to find its voice in theater, it will be hard not to listen.
The accordion playing of James Hugg, ending that report by WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Hugg can be seen as an actor in the Pig Iron Theatre Company's next production, Chekhov Lizard Brain, which opens March 28th, while Jorg Cousinou is the sound designer for the Arden Theatre's next show, Caroline or Change, which opens March 14th. In today's world, where talks among nations suffer frequent breakdowns, some hope the arts can become the new Henry Kissinger. Touring concert ensembles become musical ambassadors, able to travel where their governmental counterparts cannot. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis reports on a group that's taking this musical diplomacy one step further, as musicians from different traditions join together to share with audiences their intercultural journeys.
I would like to start with the words of Martin Luther King Jr., and he said, "People fail to get along with each other because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they have not communicated with each other." And we're using
Philadelphia Orchestra cellist Udi Bar David stands at the front of the stage, speaking to the concert audience.
Please, let's give a warm applause to Maestro Shizuo Kuwahara and the one and only Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is not an ordinary concert, for the people on stage are off. The program features music from the classical repertoire, Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev, but also new music, new to much of this audience, and new even to many of the orchestra musicians, even though the melodies are centuries old. Familiar strings will sing, trombones and trumpets will blare, but the sound of a riz, an oud, and tabla will also fill the hall. And whereas concerts are sometimes just about the music, this one is equally about where the music and the musicians come from. Performing with the orchestra is Bar David on cello and his colleagues in a diverse ensemble.
Michel Bakluk of Lebanon on the rig, our own Angie Nelson of the Philadelphia Orchestra on the tabla, Margot Leveret of the U.S. on the clarinet, Karim Rustum of Syria on the oud, and Hana Khoury, who is Arab-Israeli, on the violin.
These musicians are part of Intercultural Journeys, the name given to this concert series for children and families, but also the name of a group co-founded by Bar David, dedicated to fostering understanding among people of different cultures through music and other arts. A native of Israel, Bar David has been with the Philadelphia Orchestra since 1987, but has also nurtured a solo and chamber music career. He says that over the last 7 or 8 years, Intercultural Journeys evolved from his individual collaborations with musicians from a host of different traditions, including African and Native American, Buddhist and Palestinian.
The first one was the African-American Jewish cultures based on Hasidic songs and spirituals. Subsequently, I found myself performing with Simon Shaheen, very famous Palestinian oud player, and we developed an Arab-Jewish musical dialogue.
Now, with a core group of 10 to 15 musicians who play together in different combinations, Bar David says Intercultural Journeys partners with like-minded groups in an ever-expanding network.
It's a very interesting world, the world of cross-cultural music, because you get together with performers that I do not normally find or get together in my classical world. It's like links develop, like websites, you know, all of a sudden you just find each other.
I met Udi by accident. He was at a wedding that I played at, and we started playing music together. And
Margot Leveret is a New York-based clarinet player.
I'm always interested in putting different kinds of music together and seeing what emerges, but I'm also interested in the political aspect of it, anything that we can do to bring people together.
The quality of the music making and Bar David's reputation was a draw for Arab-Israeli Hana Khoury.
The idea to play with Udi himself first, that it's going to be something good.
Khoury was already involved in another cross-cultural collaboration as principal violinist in Daniel Barenboim's East-West Divan Orchestra. Its members include Jewish Israelis, Palestinians, and Arabs from neighboring countries. Barenboim, in speaking to WRTI last year, said that the dynamics of getting along in an orchestra mirror those in a larger society.
If you play in an orchestra, it's not enough to play your instrument well. You have to know your place. You have to know the note that you play. If you're in the second violin, you have to know not only to play it soft or loud, short or long, but you have to know where is it in the chord with the rest of the orchestra. In the same way that you have to know what your place is in society. If you don't know what your place is in society, you will not get anywhere in the world.
While Barenboim's orchestra provides a forum to work together on music from the standard symphonic repertoire, Khoury says Intercultural Journeys takes the idea of joining different cultures even one step further.
We are playing each other's music, and we are trying to listen to what that culture is all about. And this is very important, listening, because that's the main problem. Nobody seems to want to listen. They just want to talk and talk and talk. And so try to listen and to see how we can fit and blend together.
Fitting and blending Middle Eastern melodies with Western music typically played by the Philadelphia Orchestra is not simple. Like Arabic, Greek, or Chinese alphabets that use different characters for spoken sound, the Western and Eastern musical systems use different modes, or scales, to express musical notes. While Western music moves in halftones up the scale, Eastern music uses quarter tones and contemplates many more notes within each step. Yet, the pleasant irony? While their people may not always get along, Arab and Israeli music, says Leveret, fit together incredibly well.
As soon as we sat down to play together, sparks began to fly, good sparks, because it shouldn't be a surprise, but the klezmer clarinet and the Arab violin just work together. You put those two kinds of music together, and it makes organic sense.
The medley Deine Hora Freilichs was arranged by Syrian composer Karim Rustum, who plays the oud and whose work Eastern Breezes is also featured in the concert. Leveret's clarinet sings a klezmer melody, echoed and intertwined with the song of Khoury's violin.
The first time I listened to Margot at play, I immediately felt like this, like huge emotions, like I just came out of that instrument. And I was like, it inspired me to play. Now, when I start playing, like the way I was feeling, you know, like that melody should be, in a sense, it brought completely different elements. But, you know, it was, the passion was there. The emotions were there. It's a lot of spices in this music that you will not find in classical Western music.
Few would deny that people making music together and sharing commonalities of cultures that too often clash is a good thing, as far as it goes. But that's the rub. How far does it go? How do you reach those who won't come to the concerts? How do you change minds that are made up on the basis of what airs on TV? Can bridges be built from artistic harmonies to political coalitions? Bar David says that art can create a safe environment where people listen to one another.
At that point, you can go into any subject, including political subjects, but you start from a much better point of view.
Still, he admits he runs into skeptics all the time.
Well, they say, first of all, you're naive. Yeah, it's nice to play music together, but that's it. You're not going to resolve any of the political, the wars and the conflicts that are going on.
And you respond how?
You may be right, but I am determined to be a part of the change toward resolution, because I don't think the Middle East can continue the way it is right now. It will not survive. And it's not even a matter of being a Jew or being an Arab. It just will not survive.
Bar David and his colleagues do not pretend to be politicians or have all the answers to political strife. But coming from different places, they want to share what they have experienced, the power of music and music making, to shatter stereotypes, to bridge differences, and to open minds in the hope of creating an environment where the process of peace can begin.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The next concert in the Intercultural Journey series takes place this morning, just a few moments, at 11:30 at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall. The final concert in the series is at the same time and place on March 17th. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Hillel Hoffman, Linda Fiore, Catherine Blodgett, Lawrence Saul, and Carrie Gorn. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.